This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 236 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. We're coming off of a bit of a blizzard with a foot of snow plus, but evidently it didn't make it all the way up to you, did it, Max?
No, it sure didn't. And I'm glad you kept it down there in Pennsylvania, David. Saved us from some shoveling.
Yeah, I didn't have to do much, but I'm looking forward to spring so we can go fly our drones.
Yes.
Speaking of drones, I think that's why we're here tonight. We've got drones with arms. We've got Amazon who's bombing packages. A very, very large drone. And a videography and photography course. As well as the National Transportation Safety Board deploying drones at night. And we've got some other stories. So with that, I think we should get started. What do you think, Max?
All right, David, let's get started.
Well, our first story this episode comes from interestingengineering.com. This drone has retracting arms that allow it to pick up objects. You know, we've had drones with claws, and this is a little different, but it's still kind of creepy having these drones reach out and touch your drone. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, when you start sort of, what's the word? Anthropomorphizing, if that's the right word. Drones.
Giving it human aspects.
Yeah, that's right. Well, this is something called the origami robot. And it's something that some scientists in South Korea have developed. And the reason it's called an origami robot is because it has a sort of extensible arm that uses the origami principle of perpendicular folding. The idea is this thing can reach into places that, well, you might not be able to fly a drone otherwise. So, for example, if you need to pick up an object in a confined space where the drone can't reach, or into water, for example, or into other objects like trees and things like that, this arm extends from 40 millimeters collapsed to 70 centimeters fully extended. Kind of an interesting idea.
Now, you could have done 700 millimeters, so we can say that it takes 660 millimeters. But it is kind of cool that origami, and it sort of folds out and reminds me of the tubing we used to get for like air conditioning ducting, you know, with the wire inside of it that you can accordion. And that's really what this is. But you're able to sort of thread it also. So more uses for paper folding. Again, it's another one of those examples, Max, of people thinking out of the box and way to provide a solution. And this would be really kind of handy if you're flying it in a hazardous environment where you don't want to be manned. So you've got this kind of arm that can do what you want, though I am curious kind of how the control works.
Yes, I would love to see some video of this in action. That arm, it's kind of a rigid arm that's made out of sort of a series of rectangular boxes, and there are elastic bands inside that are used to extend this arm with a gripper at the end. It's always kind of interesting to find a sort of a melding of two different worlds, in this case, drones and origami, in order to create some capability that neither of them have by themselves. So there's an article associated with this that provides some more detail. It's an article in Science Robotics. And it's titled an origami-inspired self-locking robotic arm that can be folded flat. And we'll have a link to that journal article in the show notes if you're interested in learning more about it.
Well, okay, if you need to set something down, using a robotic arm is one way, though Amazon filed a patent for another way. Amazon Prime is now going to become a bomber in a warp sort of way. The Airlift Package Protection Airbag, or the APPA. Again, we need to use Max Flight's disclaimer with patents. Just because you make a patent doesn't necessarily mean it's going to actually go into production, but this is a different one. How to get that package from the drone to your doorstep.
That's right, David. And we've certainly seen different methods proposed. One is simply to have the drone land on a target on the ground, after which it can release the package and take off. We've also seen packages lowered by some sort of cable. There are lots of different ideas. This is a kind of a new one. In this idea, and under this patent, the package is protected by an airbag. And then the whole thing is dropped from some height by the drone. And as the patent says, this airbag may at least partially surround the package and create a container for the package. In some cases, this airbag might be inflated just prior to dropping the package from the UAV. So the inflation would happen, over the target. According to this description, the drone would have cameras so that it could also verify that the drop zone is clear of people or animals or other obstructions. So I can't wait to see if this one makes the cut when it comes to how do you deliver packages from drones.
Well, it worked for NASA, considering Mars rover landed wrapped up in airbags and bounced until it deflated the air. So it's been done and done successfully, but it is kind of interesting that Amazon keeps filing these patents and trying to find the optimal way to get you your whatever you get delivered from Amazon. You're the expert on Amazon delivery, but definitely a unique way. And like we said, it's a patent, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen, but this one I sort of kind of think is kind of viable.
Yeah, it might have some real possibilities. There's an intriguing part in the patent where it talks about a package that travels, quote, partially horizontally in order to land on an elevated balcony of a tall building. That would be quite a trick.
Eight ball corner pocket off of the rail.
Yeah.
We'll see. Well, the next item is an update from episode 184. Wow, that was a long time ago. In February 2017. Okay, it was a year ago. The Leviathan could disrupt unmanned global air freight. Nautilus CEO Alexei Matyushev. From dronebelow.com, Nautilus is building a very, very large drone, and the prototype was completed in December of last year, and low-speed taxi tests were included in February of this year, 2018. It's kind of a big airplane, huh?
It will be eventually. The prototype is just a 30-foot vehicle, 2,200 pounds. The production, if you will, version is expected to be a lot larger. It's kind of a, the drawings and models are sort of a blended wing, sort of reminiscent of a proposal that Boeing...
BWB, blended wing body.
Right. But they say they've conducted these low-speed taxi tests on the prototype, and they're making some modifications to it based on the testing that's been conducted so far. They also plan to begin medium-speed taxi testing within the next few weeks, as we record this, at the end of March 2018. They're doing this in the San Francisco Bay Area. the testing is occurring in the San Francisco Bay Area. We see that the prototype is powered by a Rotax, a 100 horsepower Rotax general aviation engine. That sort of gives you an idea for the size and capabilities. But Nautilus expects that this kind of a design could reduce global air freight costs by 50%, which is that's quite an aggressive, I guess, target. Certainly a very significant reduction, cut the costs in half, if that can be done. But yeah, this is another area, another application where I think people are kind of comfortable with using autonomous drones to deliver freight, especially transoceanic, so that if something does go horribly wrong, you're most of the time not over land masses.
Yeah, I've always liked the blended wing body, so I have to admit I kind of like the looks of this.
Mm.
And one of the reasons why Boeing had always claimed how efficient the blended wing body was for carrying large loads and was highly efficient as far as lift goes, so and fuel economy. So if that's what they're using as a basis, and then you're eliminating those costly sleeves, as they call them on the new show that I'm watching, those meat people things aboard, I can understand why they're saying 50% reduction. Still got a long way to go because people are going to feel comfortable flying in the airspace. But if you're flying transoceanic, that's a lot of places. And the worst that'll happen is you'll lose whatever cargo you have aboard. And that's why they have insurance. So interesting. We'll keep following up on it. I'd like to see the prototype fly. That would be kind of cool because I just like the look of the blended wing body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another aspect that Boeing had, I think, maybe some difficulty with a blended wing aircraft is passenger seating. You end up with not so many window seats and a large number of seats in the interior, almost like stadium seating kind of an arrangement, which maybe is not something that many air passengers would be too excited about. But if you're moving freight, who cares? You know, you can go with the most efficient body type, and the freight doesn't care how it's jammed in, fitted in, and whether there's a window viewing for the cargo. So, yeah, this is a great application for it.
Our next story actually comes from, is it a press release? And it was from David Kramer from Third Rock Air. They are announcing a drone photography and videography course. And they're in Tampa, Florida, and they're a drone training company. Of course, they do drone skills, Part 107 knowledge test skills. But what I thought was interesting was this is a photography skills shot and a videography. Both Max and I are photographers. And just because you have a really good camera doesn't mean that you can take a photograph compared to a picture. You do need to have photography skills if you're going to be a good drone photographer, in my opinion, because all the drone is the camera. If you fly it really well, great, but you need to learn basics of photography. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And Third Rock found that many of their students lacked the kind of detailed photography and videography skills that makes you effective. Like, as you say, David, you just can't buy a GoPro camera, which is a great camera, and automatically assume that you're going to get great video. So they're going to get into the details in this course, histograms, frame rates, neutral density filters, depth of field, color balances, as well as things like rules of composition, editing, just a whole litany of topics that if you want to be a good photographer or a good videographer, you have to understand these things. So, yeah, I think this is something that professionals especially will benefit from. But the course is also, as I understand it, available to hobbyists as well as commercial users. So I think everybody is welcome And if you're really serious about it, I mean, these are the kinds of skills you need to develop.
And absolutely. I mean, gone are the days. I read some of this stuff, and it reminded me of my high school photography class with my Pentax K1000, which basically you had to do everything by yourself, and then developing the film and everything. But you learn to be a better photographer. It's easy to shoot digital now because I know how to take pictures. And yeah, I mean, I think everybody needs to shoot a roll of film and then wait 6 weeks for it to come back, carefully wondering if you actually got the shot that you really wanted. Well, if anybody does take the course, we'll have links in the show notes to Third Rock Air, and let us know. It sounds like it's a really good course and well thought out, and it wouldn't hurt. Being a good photographer is a good thing. Being a good drone pilot's the same, but I mean, having both of those skills is really helpful.
And I think, David, the bar is rising when it comes to drone videos and aerial photography from drones. I think at the beginning, just the fact that you had a unique perspective, an unusual perspective that you could achieve with a drone, really got you a lot of credibility when it comes to the quality of your finished work. But I think the bar is, as I said, is rising, and you know, no longer is the uniqueness of the aerial view sufficient to declare that this is a great video. I think photographic skills are going to become more and more important, especially if you're, as I say, in a commercial arena and competing with others. So, you know, whether it's training of these skills through Third Rock or some other source, I think that there are quite a few drone operators that need to look at themselves critically and consider this kind of training.
And let's face it, drones are pretty democratized right now. Anybody can take a decent picture with a DJI Phantom. But if you want to take a really good photograph, then this is the kind of class you need. And you'd be surprised how much it transfers into your day-to-day photography about your family or your friends or your landscapes. Having that eye just makes everything better for you. It's skills. I mean, there is some dumb luck to photography, but a lot of it is taking the time and framing the shot, etc. And a lot of it now with digital photography is post-processing, you know, what software you're going to use so people can see it, etc. So I guess on that, we should move on to one of our favorite government programs. I actually got to meet our favorite National Transportation Safety Board member at Maryland, and that would be Bill English, who is the head of the drone program at the NTSB. But AOPA.org says, NTSB deploys drones at night. And Bill English is quoted, friend of the show.
Bill is the guy who developed the NTSB drone procedures for accident investigations. And as a part of doing that, the NTSB received an FAA authorization to fly a drone at night. As we see in this article from AOPA, Bill's thoughts were initially directed at aircraft accidents at night, and being able to use a drone at night to recreate the visual of the accident. But what we have here is a different kind of an accident that still falls under the NTSB's purview, and that being a bus crash. And you may have seen this in the news in the last few weeks. The bus was carrying a high school band, and it veered off the road into a ravine. This occurred at night, and the driver was killed, unfortunately. Well, the NTSB is investigating this, and they had the waiver. They had the procedures, and they had a DJI Phantom 4 Pro, which they have pressed into service for this investigation.
interesting. We were talking about photography, and this is where you start learning in things like camera settings were set at ISO 800 and shutter speed were set at 1/25th, are a good starting point at dusk. So in order to be able to do this, you needed photography skills to set the lighting setting. Because what the NTSB and Bill were using was they were trying to simulate what actually the driver saw by flying the drone down the path. And what Bill English found out was at night, the ISO needs to be boosted to at least 1600. So these kind of film skills are kind of important. They had to do a lot of things for the waiver for the FAA. Now, the NTSB is not exempt from the FAA rules. So to require the fly at night, the drone has to be visible to all aircraft within 3 statute miles. So to this DJI 4, they added a high-intensity LED strobe, which is a Cree LED strobe. And in the waiver application, they used data from a nightlight visibility from the U.S. Coast Guard. The light was extremely bright and small enough to be mounted on top of the Phantom. Note that when they were going for the waiver, they actually used data to show to support their argument for the waiver. That's kind of what we were talking about with being a partner with the FAA, doing your research up front, like Bill did, finding all of the documentation so the FAA can give the waiver instead of having to go back and forth for information. So overall, I think this was a good step forward. Congratulations to the NTSB and Bill English. And it's nice to know the drone is surveying the crash and not part of it for once. Well, moving on to our next story. This is again from AOPA.org. Aspen Avionics and drone maker Centurion Aerospace are partnering. They want to develop avionics for autonomous air taxis and unmanned aircraft. This was sent to us by our friend Max Trescott, drone operator and Cirrus pilot extraordinaire. And he's been familiar with them because they've worked with glass cockpits. In this case, they're developing more avionics for drones and unmanned aerial systems. So they're moving beyond.
Yes, this looks like another example of a couple of companies with some expertise in certain areas combining their resources and creating something that is new and greater than each of them. You say, David, Aspen offers glass panels. You can retrofit your general aviation airplane that comes with gauges.
Steam gauges.
And these Aspen panels can replace those. Centurion is a drone company. They provide data collection services. They've also developed some of their own unmanned platforms, fixed wing, and maybe some others as well. And so what we see is these two companies getting together to look ahead into the future at, in this case, autonomous air taxis as well as other unmanned aircraft, and develop the avionics that are required for those. So I think this will be a great pairing to follow and watch as they develop these capabilities. I imagine that those who are developing autonomous air taxis and so forth probably want to limit the different subsystems that they want to become experts in order to put together the total aircraft. So having a drone expert and an avionics expert combine their resources, that's probably going to be pretty valuable for those looking to develop some of these autonomous aircraft.
And hopefully these air taxis will fly safely, unlike our next taxi story. Now, this is the UAV Digest, which is unmanned aerial vehicles, but we've talked about cars, and we've talked about ships, and we've talked about submersibles, and this was kind of disturbing, but it does fall into the autonomy field. And this was from money.cnn.com. Uber self-driving car kills pedestrian in first fatal autonomous crash. So Uber had a fatality with a driverless car in Arizona. And it was going to happen inevitably, but it's interesting how it happened.
A woman was walking her bicycle across a street in Arizona. I don't know if she was in a crosswalk or not, but she was struck and killed by this self-driving Uber. Now, there was an operator in the vehicle, we understand. There was an Uber test driver, but it seems that at the time, the vehicle, it was a Volvo, was being operated autonomously. It was driving itself. And in response, Uber said that it's going to stop testing these vehicles throughout the United States and Canada. I'm sure the investigation is going to be extremely important in order to understand what happened here. But David, you know, it occurs to me that whether we're talking about autonomous cars or aircraft or, you know, all the other things that you mentioned, it's still a device that, you know, is a transportation vehicle of some sort operating autonomously. And I think that there's a lot of technologies that are shared across those different modes of transportation. Now, obviously, each of them have their own technologies that only apply to that mode. But there are a lot of concepts that apply across the board. So I think for that reason, when there's an autonomous automobile issue in this case, or an autonomous aircraft or undersea vehicle, whatever it is that those who are looking to develop and further the use of autonomous vehicles certainly need to pay attention and understand what's going on. I think the investigation will have some results that probably would be applicable to autonomous drones as well. What do you think, David?
I agree. Autonomy is autonomy. I learned that back at Langley with the Autonomy Institute at NASA. You have to be able to sense and avoid. In this case, it failed. So we'll have to keep following up on, we'll keep following up on this story because the ramifications of this story are for all across all things. It was an autonomous vehicle and it had a fatality. So let's hope that even though we feel bad for the family, that something can be learned and gained from, and they can figure out quickly what went wrong, because we don't want this stuff to happen, and we don't want the negative publicity that, you know, driverless cars are taking out pedestrians. So I guess on that note, we should probably wrap this up on a more positive note. So we probably should have flipped the story and had the Uber story first and the investigation from the Transportation Safety Board after it, but we'll follow up. So what do you think, Max? Should we wrap this up?
Yeah, for sure. We want to thank all of you for listening to the UAV Digest. This is episode 236. You can find show notes for this episode at the uavdigest.com/236. We'll have some links to the news stories we talked about, as well as some other resources that you can take a look at. And of course, we are all over social media. David, where can they find us online?
They can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest. And we are now officially recognized by the FAA as one of their retweeters. So we'll be keeping up on that so we can get all the FAA news out to you, our listeners. We can be found on Facebook at facebook.com/theUAVDigest. Send us an email at feedback@theuavdigest.com. And by using that email address, you can become part of our Slack listener team. We'd love for you to join us to get into the conversation and to talk about all things drones, as well as sneaking into the Airplane Geeks ones also, and some of the other random ones that are just fun. You can purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. We'd love for you to leave a review on Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or Stitcher.com. And again, leave us some feedback at feedback@theuavdigest.com. I'd like to thank our listeners that have sent good wishes and remedies to me for my last 2 weeks of flu. And you know who you are. And I am getting better, I promise. I will not be out like I was in 2015. So I guess with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.